Session number 10888.
Mr. Hutchison, reel two.
There was quite a lot to do with the repairs, and the one diver couldn't cope without somebody to keep dressing him and looking after his lines. So he asked one of the pumping party if they would volunteer to look after him. I thought it would be better to look after him than keep heaving round that heavy pump all day long. And so I was then taken on as his linesman attendant. This carried on for several weeks, and I was looking after him, dressing him, tending his lines, giving him tools. Eventually, the work became too much for the one man on his own, and a repair party of divers was sent from the UK to the ship at Freetown, and they still kept me as the diver's linesman and tending the cutting gear which they'd brought out with them to do all the burning of the damaged steelwork. And eventually one of these divers that came from the UK said to me, "Oh, you seem very interested, would you like a dive?" Being young and innocent in those days, 17 years old, I said, "Oh yes, I'd love to have a dive." And they immediately threw me a suit and said, "Get into it." So my very first dive was in the hole of where this torpedo caused all the damage, to take some tools down to the diver that was actually working. It frightened the life out of me, but nevertheless I became quite interested. And after that, if there's any small diving jobs to do, such as taking an odd tool down to a diver or take a wire or whatever is necessary, and the diving team didn't want to do it because it was such a small job, they used to ask me to do it. So I got quite interested. And by the time we carried out the necessary repairs to move the ship from Freetown to Gibraltar, I was getting quite proficient at it. By the time we got to Gibraltar, the diving team had left, leaving only the one diver and myself on board, and we were held back in Gibraltar because the heavy bombing had started in the UK, and we were due to go to Portsmouth to have the necessary repairs carried out. So because we were held in Gibraltar, because they didn't send the ship back, we became the base divers for Gibraltar, and we had all sorts of odd jobs to do, working on the ships, clearing foul propellers, picking up bombs that had been dropped, any necessary work that a diver was required to do. One thing I remember quite plainly was one day we had a storm blow up in Gibraltar, and the ship's boats weren't able to be picked out of the water because of the suddenness of the storm, and they were sent into the harbour to anchor until the storm blew itself out. When they went to recover the anchor, it got fouled and couldn't be cleared. So they asked the divers to go and clear this anchor for them. The ship's diver asked me to do this job because he thought it would be a nice job for me to do. I went down, cleared the anchor. And then he said, "Oh, well, you may as well just have a little walk. Just follow your lines along the bottom." Only I thought, as I kept walking, I'm going quite a long way. And then after a time, he said, "You can come up now," only to find that he'd walked me all the way across the bottom of Gibraltar Harbour from the inshore HMS Cormorant to the detached mole, which was about the best part of a mile.
He did it as a joke?
He did it as a joke.
How do you clear an anchor?
Well, all that had happened, but the fluke of the anchor had got hooked under a rock, and no matter how they pulled it, it just wouldn't come clear. But once I got to the bottom and the water was clear in Gibraltar, you could see it was just a matter of laying it down and tipping it a certain way, and then it came clear.
So it wasn't necessarily hard work?
Oh, no, there's nothing hard about it at all.
Now, you said that you were transferred to an American Coast Guard cutter.
Yes, that's correct.
When did that come about?
Well, after we left Gibraltar, the ship did go to Portsmouth, but because of the heavy bombing that was going on at that particular time, they decided to send the ship to America. And we were one of the first ships to go to America under the Lend-Lease system for repairs. And we were sent to Philadelphia, where the repairs were carried out. Because of the amount of time that it was going to do to carry out the repairs, quite a number of the ship company were transferred to various ships. And I was transferred to an American Coast Guard cutter, which used to be the US Coast Guard vessel Cayuga, but was renamed HMS Totland. And we were transferred with the American crew on board to show us how the ship was run. And it was a diesel-electric driven vessel. And we came over back to England. On the way over, we dropped some depth charges, which were the American type, which were found to be inefficient to the modern anti-submarine warfare that was required. So we were sent to East Ham into the docks for the proper British depth charges to be attached to this ship and depth charge throwers. And we were then employed on various convoys which were either Atlantic or West African convoys. One of the things that used to happen, which was not very amusing at the time, but when you think about it afterwards you can smile about, was the fact that once they put the British depth charges on board, they were much more powerful than the American type. And if we did an attack, submarine attack, and we dropped depth charges set at shallow depths, it used to blow all the fuses on the board in the engine room. And so if we had to do an attack, we had to inform the engine room that an attack was being carried out. And the chief EA, electrical artificer, job during the attack was to stand by the board with a tea chest full of fuses to replace them as we blew them off the board. But being as the ship was diesel electric, once the fuses went, everything went off the board. That meant all the steering, all the lights, everything, the engines completely stopped for the few minutes that the fuses could be replaced.
How much success did you have against enemy submarines, do you think?
Well, as far as we know, we never ever sunk one. We dropped numerous depth charges. Whether we ever did, we didn't know. We never recovered any survivors. We never saw any oil spilt. But you're a deterrent more than... I think any vessel until the submarine warfare improved considerably. It was just a deterrent that you were. You dropped the depth charges to frighten them away more than try to sink them. But we never ever sunk one as far as I know.
What was the armament of the Totland?
The Totland had quite amusing armament. She had 2 5-inch guns and 2 3-inch anti-aircraft guns. The way the 3-inch guns were fired was with a car battery. So you had to have this car battery charged up all the time to fire the anti-aircraft guns.
Seems a rather Heath Robinson
It was quite a Heath Robinson arrangement. Eventually, some of the guns were changed, but all the time I was on Totland, we carried on under this method of firing them.
How did the convoys fare that you were escorting?
We did very well. We had some casualties. Some of the ships were attacked and sunk, but very, very few. For the amount of convoys that I can recall doing on both Resolution and Totland, I consider that we were about 85% successful in getting the ships across.
Because this was supposed to have been a very bad period.
It was a bad period. I remember we were on one particular convoy when the Bismarck was out, and we were coming over with this convoy, and we were diverted because the fact that the Bismarck was out, and although we could hear the gunfire in the distance, way in the distance, we never saw anything of the action at all, and the convoy was unscathed.
This was when the Bismarck was sunk?
Yes, that is right.
What was the Totland like to live on compared with the Resolution?
Well, the Totland, she was only a small vessel. The accommodation was very good. In fact, it was marvellous to what we've been used to, because every man had a bunk. When we first took her over, she was complete with everything that the American Coast Guard used to have. Ice cream machines, ice cold water machines, which was a luxury, but of course they didn't last long. We soon had to put up with the meagre rations that we were allowed, and especially on the West African runs, where you sailed and you were sometimes 3 weeks at sea, as it was only a small ship, after about the first 4 or 5 days, you ran out of bread, you ran out of potatoes, you lived on tinned food all the time. And then when you got to Freetown, you replenished your stocks. There was no potatoes out there. We lived on yams, which were horrible things. Fresh bread was unheard of. And conditions weren't all that good, apart from the luxury of that you've got a nice bunk to get into instead of a hammock.
What was the health of the crew like?
Well, the health was very good. I mean, the only health problems that we ever had was when I was on another ship, which was torpedoed, which we may come across in the interview. But all in all, living under the conditions that we did, I considered that the health of the ship's companies was very good.
You said then you became a base diver at Ardrossan.
Yes, that's correct. After I qualified diver, I was sent to Ardrossan as a base diver, and we were expected to look after all the small ships in Ardrossan, Lamlash and Eyre, which were all minesweeper and submarine bases. And we had problems clearing foul propellers with all the mine sweeping equipment, all the wires, etc., which was quite hard. Underwater cutting gear was very primitive in those days. 80% of the time it wouldn't work. So most of the work had to be done by hacksaw and hammer and chisel. But one thing that was quite unusual was that we had as our diving boat a Norwegian fishing vessel that had escaped from Norway with a Norwegian captain on board, but the pumping party that we had was a crowd of wrens, which was quite amusing. But nevertheless, it was one of those things that had to happen during the war. There wasn't the labour available and the wrens, but they were very good and they used to look after us very well. Cups of tea were always available, and often a little extra goody came along from them, from the wrens' quarters. But it was quite interesting.
What do you mean an extra goody?
Well, and such as perhaps a cake or some pies or something like that that normally you wouldn't get.
You joined HMS Phoebe in 1942. What kind of a ship was she?
Well, she was one of the new anti-aircraft cruisers that was built. She was built with a brand new gun, which was a 5.25 dual-purpose high-angle, low-angle gun. There were about six or eight of these ships built. They were very fast, and they acted as escorts to all the major convoys, and they were a very, very efficient ship as an anti-aircraft ship.
Do you remember when you joined the Phoebe?
I joined her in 1942. That was just at the time that I got married. I remember I had 24 hours after I was married, and then I had to go away, and I was away for nearly 2 years. During that time, we were involved in several major convoys. The worst one was the pedestal convoy, when we took the aircraft and the ships to Malta, which was the last relief of Malta that they considered. If that convoy didn't, or some of that convoy didn't get through, Malta would fall. It was a very, very bad convoy from the points of attacks. We acted as anti-aircraft ship to HMS Indomitable. Each one of these anti-aircraft cruisers was given the escort job to support one of the aircraft carriers. I remember quite plainly seeing HMS Eagle being sunk, and we were very close to the Indomitable when she was hit with bombs and very, very badly damaged. In fact, she had to withdraw because she was so badly damaged. But some of the things that happened on that convoy were most unusual. One thing that stands out in my mind particularly was we had HMS Rodney, which was a 16-inch battleship, and we were being attacked by low-level Italian torpedo aircraft. And I remember quite plainly seeing the 16-inch guns being trained round to port, and she fired a barrage of 16-inch shells to drop just short of the aircraft. And at a particular time, there were about eight torpedo craft attacking in formation. At a very low level. The Rodney fired these 16-inch shells. We saw the huge splash on the horizon, and there were no more aircraft left. They flew straight into the barrage with the shells, and it completely wiped them all out. But that was the first time that I'd ever seen the main armament of a battleship used as an anti-aircraft gun.
Can you describe the loss of the Eagle?
The Eagle, she was steaming along some distance from us, but suddenly we heard these bangs in the distance. And when I looked, Eagle was listing quite heavily, and the destroyers were racing across to assist her. dropping depth charges as they went. She was torpedoed, I believe two torpedoes hit her, and she sunk within 10 to 15 minutes.
How many hits were scored on Phoebe on pedestal?
Phoebe was lucky. She wasn't hit at all. We were bombed quite heavily, but they were mainly after either the capital ships, the aircraft carriers, or the merchant ships. They weren't interested in the smaller vessels. But nevertheless, we saw torpedoes being fired at us. We had bombs dropped fairly close to us. But it was mainly the merchant ships they were after.
Did they get them?
Oh yes, there was quite a number of them sunk. One in particular, which a lot of people, the older wartime people will remember, was the tanker Ohio. She was the American tanker that had to be escorted in. She had been bombed, torpedoed, had aircraft crash on her deck, and she had to be escorted into Malta. She got to Malta, supported by two destroyers, one each side of her, to keep her afloat. But it was quite a feat for the captain to get her into Malta. It did still have a certain amount of fuel left on board, which they said saved the Spitfires and Hurricanes that were still left on Malta, were just about out of fuel. After Pedestal, they said that the raids began to drop off. Now they considered it was the convoy that saved Malta.
Did Phoebe go right into Malta?
No, we had to turn back with Indomitable to escort her back to Gibraltar because of the heavy damage and casualties that she'd got on board.
Do you think Phoebe brought any enemy aircraft down on Pedestal?
I'm sure she did, but there was so much anti-aircraft fire that you didn't know whether you were hitting them or not. I know for a fact that even some of our own aircraft from the carriers were shot down possibly by the anti-aircraft fire because it was so heavy. Every ship was using up ammunition so much and the attacks were so heavy that it was impossible to tell. I mean, you saw planes on fire, crashing into the sea. You didn't know whether they were German or British because we had a lot of the fighters up off the carriers to try and help the convoy. And remember one particular thing that happened was that the raids went on so late into the evening that by the time all the raids were finished, the fighters off the carrier had to land in the darkness. And although the enemy was so close, they had to switch on their landing lights and the carrier had to illuminate the deck to get the vessel, the aircraft back on board, which was a most unusual thing to have lights on during a convoy so close to the enemy.
Was it impressed on you before you went on Pedestal the importance of getting through?
No, not really. It was just another convoy. We set sail from Gibraltar. We were told that we were hoping to take these supplies to Malta. We knew it was fairly important with the number of ships that were involved, the capital ships, cruisers, destroyers, and the number of merchant ships that were going.
Which other duties stick out in your mind from your days on Phoebe?
Well, we did escorts down to Cape Town and we did patrols off the South African coast against German and Japanese raiders, which we knew were in the area, although we never ever found them. We did quite a number of patrols off Cape Town. We were based at Simonstown and I remember very well. Probably a number of the old sailors will remember the dog that was at Simonstown. that used to look after the sailors. He was a huge Great Dane, and he used to look after sailors that were drunk, and he was known to drag them back into the base to get them back on board. He absolutely was devoted to sailors.
Did he have a name?
Yes, I can't recall the name offhand now, but I'm sure some of the old sailors remember him very well.
Who did he belong to?
He belonged to the captain of the base.
So he trained him to do this, didn't he?
I don't know. He was a well-known figure. He used to, when the ship's companies used to go ashore, he used to know the times, roughly about 4:30 in the evening, when they were going, and he used to join them on the train from Simonstown to Cape Town, and he'd stay wandering around the station until such times it was due to come back. And if there was any of them that couldn't get back, he used to drag them back on the train. I can't recall the name of him, but he was very, very well known.
Presumably he got treated by the sailors then, didn't
Oh,
he?
Yes, yes, they adored him.
Any other combat duties you had on Phoebe that you remember?
My action station on there was, I was a trainer on one of the 5.25 gun turrets. You didn't see much action inside the turret when you were firing. All you knew was that the guns were being fired. The trainer's position was on the starboard side of the turret, and apart from the noise of the guns going off, that's all you could see. Because you used to follow a pointer on a dial in the turret, which was being controlled by the director, which was the only place that would see what was actually going on.
So you were on board the Phoebe when she was torpedoed?
Yes, we were on our way to the Sicily landings. We were left Simonstown, and what happened was that I was actually doing a dive in Simonstown Harbour when I was called up from the bottom, and we had a hurry-up signal to sail immediately from Simonstown to attend the Sicily landings. On our way, we had to call in West Africa to a place called Point Noir, which was in French Equatorial Africa. And because of the hurry that we left Simonstown Harbour,